Welcome to Climate Radio. We're here with four distinguished guests in the studio discussing the issue of climate change and democracy. It seems to me that increasingly we face some sort of democratic crisis in the UK. It's difficult not to witness, for example, the financial crisis and wonder why ordinary people have been asked to pay for the reckless behaviour of the banks and why bankers still get obscene bonuses when ordinary people are facing cuts to jobs, wages, benefits and public services. Similarly, when it comes to climate change, we see time and time again, I've been doing this show since about 2003, and you see it again and again, how civil society struggles to get government to do the right thing to respond to the climate science, and the government's default position is to side with powerful vested interests. So it's tempting to ask whether, as former World Bank economist Joseph Stiglitz put it, we have a government of the 1%, by the 1% and for the 1%. So over the next hour, we're going to look at just how bad our democratic deficit is in the UK. And I'll be asking our guests if corporate capture of government really is the single issue holding progressive politics back. Should we be switching from fighting single-issue campaigns to uniting behind a single campaign focusing on democratic reform? In the studio, we've got Jamie Kelsey-Fry from the New Internationalist Cooperative and Occupy London, Emma Hughes from the Oil Industry Watchdog Platform London, and Alex Scrivener from WDM. On the telephone, we are joined by Eva Jasiewicz. Did I have the pronunciation right?
Jasiewicz.
Okay. Best known as a member of the direct action group No Dash for Gas, who recently occupied and shut down a gas-fired power station. So welcome, everybody.
Hi.
Thanks.
Hello.
Alex, can I ask you first about the Web of Power report that you've just written for the World Development Movement? When we think about how corporations capture government, we might think about the number of meetings that corporations get with ministers, or perhaps the payments that rich businessmen give to political parties. But I think your report really discovers a whole nother level to this. I was tempted to call it corruption earlier, but what was the finding of your report?
Well, I mean, essentially, I mean, our report was about sort of exposing the sort of web of power and connections that sort of bind us to the high carbon economy here in the UK. I mean, we've all heard of the military-industrial complex, and this basically is about exposing what's sort of an energy finance complex within our politics and within our society. We have a situation in which, you know, a third of UK government ministers have had some kind of link with either the oil industry or with the financial sector, which is behind bankrolling high carbon companies and climate change to the tune of billions and billions of pounds. And, you know, this is a crisis for kind of our democratic system, and it's a crisis for the climate as well. When we have a government in which four ministers have worked for Shell alone, you know, Vince Cable is the business secretary, William Hague used to work for Shell, Alan Duncan, Elizabeth Truss, you know, these people and many others in the government, and as I said, it's a third if you include all the people linked to the financial sector as well, have these links. And I think that's a very dangerous thing, and that's what this report is there to expose.
Yeah, it certainly looks like we don't have a... If you took an average sample of the British public, they wouldn't look like the people that are actually members of the cabinet. It's actually a very select group that have very particular web of interests. But as you say, just how many of these people have worked for the oil industry in the past is quite shocking alone. Could you name some of these people?
Yeah, I mean, I said Vince Cable is obviously the most well-known. I mean, he's the business secretary. He was actually chief economist for Shell for many years. But, I mean, there are others. William Hague used to work for Shell. You know, George Osborne and others, they didn't work for the oil industry, but they have accepted donations from sort of various hedge funds. Oliver Letwin worked for the Rothschilds. And Michael Gove, in fact, accepted £10,000 from the chief executive of Tullow Oil. And when we hear things like, you know, Michael Gove deciding to leave climate change out of the school curriculum, it does make us think. You know, these same people are accepting donations from the oil industry, from the financial sector, which has actually not much less interest in perpetuating the high carbon economy as the oil companies themselves. They're invested to such a strong degree in oil companies. I mean, if you look at sort of the top five banks in the UK, put £170 billion into underwriting the bonds and shares of oil companies and coal mining companies over the last 3 years alone. So, you know, they're massively invested in the high carbon economy. And these politicians are part of that mix, whether they're linked indirectly through the financial sector, which has these interests, or linked directly by accepting donations or having worked for oil companies.
Yeah, the kind of headline that The Guardian pulled out of your report was that up to a third of all coalition ministers may have past or present links with fossil fuel companies or with financial and service companies supporting oil or gas projects. So the odds are kind of weighed against us. I mean, if you were to draw out the definition of a corporate oligarchy, this is starting to look like one, perhaps. I mean, a corporate oligarchy, a rough definition of that would be power exercised by the few in the interests of corporations and financiers. And we just looked, your report is just looking at the finance and fossil fuel element of that. So quite shocking stuff, really. Jamie made the point when we were talking earlier that this is a deep problem that's been uncovered here, and it's got relatively little media attention. It hasn't been dominating hasn't been the top story across the BBC for the last week. If you read The Guardian, perhaps you might have come across this story. But I'm going to move on to speak to Eva, if that's okay. You still there, Eva?
Yeah, I am here.
If I could ask you about just so people understand the story first, what was the issue? What motivated you and your fellow activists? I think it was a group of about 20 of you to go up to the top of the cooling towers of a gas-fired power station and camp for a week in the freezing cold, and shut this thing down. What were you thinking?
What we were thinking was that this government is planning to build up to 40. New gas-fired power stations and is planning to mortgage our energy to gas, which is a dirty, volatile, expensive fuel. It's going to push people's fuel bills up. It's going to make us crash our carbon reduction targets. We'll be in breach of our own legislation under the Climate Act of 2008. We need to make drastic reductions, really drastic reductions, and pursuing gas is not going to enable us to achieve that. So we wanted to really put a flag in the sand, take a very dramatic, direct action to flag up the government's Dash for Gas, and just as the group and the action was called, No Dash for Gas, to say we can't do this and we shouldn't do this. And that was what we were thinking, basically, that we had to do something really drastic. And it was an EDF gas-fired power station that we targeted, and it was one of the first of the new fleet that are planned for the UK, and we stopped it from going online. So we literally did stop that part of the Dash for Gas temporarily, and we were able to get a platform in the mainstream media, not a huge one. It was actually EDF then suing us that gave us even more of a platform. Yeah. So it's a massive own goal for them, but it's really, like with a lot of these actions, it's to make a concrete confrontation, but also to really highlight an issue that's being ignored.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fight here, isn't there, about the electricity bill that's going through. The government's own advisers, the Independent Committee on Climate Change, have said we need a decarbonisation target in here. This is a massive opportunity to decarbonise the UK's entire energy supply by putting a kind of a cap on the emissions that any power station can emit. And we should be ruling out new gas. This is the government's own independent advice. But did you and your fellow campaigners uncover much information about the weight of the gas lobby, and to what extent that the odds are stacked against you in this fight?
To a degree, yeah, we did. Well, we know that all of the big six energy companies, not just EDF, have been meeting with the government, and they've all had employees drafted into government to work on energy issues for at least a four-year period. I mean, this is uncovered by Freedom of Information by Caroline Lucas, MP. So, for example, there were 195 meetings with energy companies and the Department for Energy and Climate Change, compared to just 17 with Green Campaign groups. So, in a way, it's not even sort of about trying to lobby. They're in there already. You know, these energy companies are influencing policy, they're writing policy. So lobbying's not even that necessary when you're actually in government.
Yeah, I mean, there was a, I think during the week that, was it 10 days? How long did you shut down this power station for?
7 days.
Yeah, during that time, FRACOFF, a group that are campaigning against hydraulic fracturing in the UK, which is where a lot of this gas would come from if we go down this road, looked at the web of influence that the gas industry has on every kind of government department that is that will have any influence over this decision making process. And Lord Brown, the former CEO of BP, now has interest in the gas fracking industry and is a non-executive director at the Cabinet Office. And according to FRACOFF, has promoted, this is an amazing statistic and they haven't referenced it, but it's according to them, he's managed to promote 60 of his associates into positions on government boards. And that's just scratching the surface. There will be a link to a reference for this in the notes for this show. But the level of capture of the gas industry seems to be quite alarming.
Yeah. And he would have built those connections up through his connections in the oil industry and all the revolving doors that he and BP representatives have been through in government, DFID, as well as the new Department for Energy and Climate Change.
Yeah. Can I move on to Emma, who's here in the studio from Platform London? I know one of your areas of expertise is looking at how oil and gas companies influence our foreign policy and perhaps skewer it in a way that perhaps the bulk of the population wouldn't like if they knew actually what was going on. Is there some concrete examples you can give about what's happening there?
Yeah, sure. And the UK's foreign policy isn't just skewed, I suppose. In some parts of the world, it's entirely determined by the interests of big oil and gas. The former Foreign Secretary, Douglas Hurd, once said that there are some parts of the world where the most important British interest was BP's operation. And he said that in 1993, but I think it's just as true today as it was then. And, you know, in other parts of the world, it will be Shell's interests that they're representing. But in some places, the main aim of Britain's foreign policy is simply to make oil and gas extraction more easy and more profitable for a few very big corporations. And they assist BP's and Shell's ability to do business in almost 100 countries in which they operate. And this support has stretched over, you know, many, many decades. And in effect, it's a massive subsidy from the British state to oil corporations. So, I mean, in some places, I guess it's fairly sort of spoken about and well known about. So in Iraq, for example, as Greg Muttett's book Fuel on the Fire showed, British and American officials worked tirelessly to ensure that Iraq's nationalised oil industry ended up in the hands of multinational corporations. And we have, you know, quite well-known examples as well, like Blair flying into Libya to support BP's CEO Tony Hayward, who was signing a deal with the Libyan National Oil Company. And for BP, this deal was absolutely crucial. It was the single largest exploration commitment in BP's 100-year history. And that deal was made much more likely by Blair's support.
This was when Gaddafi was in power.
Yeah, exactly, when Gaddafi was in power. And Blair went and shook Gaddafi's hand. And This is a far, you know, from isolated examples, you know, day-to-day phone calls and intelligence gathering on behalf of BP and Shell are really core activities for UK embassies abroad. And the costs mount up from this. So until October 2012, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office was maintaining a consulate with three diplomats in Basra, and this was largely to meet the needs and the demands of BP and Shell. And this cost added up to 6.5 million per year. And now imagine that cost multiplied in many cities across the world. And non-fossil fuel companies, obviously, they also receive diplomatic support, but the scale is just not the same as fossil fuel companies. And this doesn't just happen in the UK. It happens with Exxon in the US, Total in France. So, you know, oil companies are getting a really huge diplomatic subsidy that for them is invaluable. It makes their operations so much easier and so much more profitable.
Okay, I mean, what does this all mean for British support for human rights abroad? I mean, if presumably oil companies operate in countries where it means we have to deal with repressive dictators and regimes that are actually repressing democracy in their countries.
Yeah, I mean, completely. This means that the Foreign and Commonwealth Office is often not nearly as critical or even silent about regimes that they really should have something very critical to say about. And Azerbaijan is a good example of that. So Azerbaijan, basically, there is a repressive regime there run by one family, the Aliyevs, first of all by Heydar Aliyev and now his son Ilyam. And they have retained their power through a series of fraudulent elections that have been accompanied by repression and arrests and violence. And the state goes to long lengths to silence critics. And part of the reason that their power is so entrenched is that they get a lot of money from BP to extract oil from Azerbaijan. And BP have basically, they give the Aliyevs wealth, which means that they don't have to listen to the demands of the people. They're not reliant on taxpayers' money. It really entrenches their power. And in return, BP benefit from this being a very repressive place where people can't speak out because it silences criticism about their operations. And part of the reason that BP have been able to operate in Azerbaijan is the UK government's support for them. And I'm going to tell a bit of a topical anecdote. I realise people may be bored of stories of Margaret Thatcher, but this one's a little bit different, so I don't think you will have heard it before. It's about how BP came to win the contract in the first place to extract crude oil from Azerbaijan. So in 1992, when Azerbaijan was a newly formed republic, it found itself being courted by a number of oil companies who were eager to get their hands on Azeri oil from this state that had just separated from the Soviet Union. And BP was one of the companies vying to win the contract. And they turned to the Foreign Office and said, "We really need this contract. It's absolutely crucial. Can you provide some support?" And the Foreign Office offered to send Michael Heseltine, a very high-profile figure, to ensure that the deal went ahead. However, the Azeris were not happy with Michael Heseltine. They felt that Margaret Thatcher, who had resigned 2 years earlier, was a far more enticing prospect, especially as they'd just broken away from Soviet Russia. So this woman who represented so much of a capitalism, they were very keen to have her there. And so she went along at the behest of BP. She sat there at the signing of the contract with a union jack in front of her, and she personally handed over checks from BP worth 30 million, which were part of a total of 90 million from BP to win the contract. And this, you know, continues today, foreign policy machinery being used in Azerbaijan to support BP's operations. So we recently did a Freedom of Information Act where we found the Foreign Office and the UK ambassador to Azerbaijan talking about the falling oil production and tensions between Aliyev and BP in relation to that. And the Foreign Office's immediate concern was, what can we do for BP? How can we help them? And that they specifically said, we need to take a lead from BP to see how we can help them.
All right, I mean, it's quite shocking stuff. I mean, we can also think, I guess, this is going to be replicated, isn't it, from across a number of countries. You know, the Saudis, obviously, the royal family there, very repressive, which is an obvious one that comes to mind. But, Jamie, I wonder if I could ask you about, I mean, through your activity with Occupy London, I know you've been involved with a working group there looking at corporations. Are we seeing this corporate capture reflected in other areas, such as healthcare, local government services, regulation of mining companies? Is this a pattern that's being repeated across a number of sectors?
Well, with the selling off of the NHS, it seems to be very much the case. So Occupy, NIS aside, for New Internationalist aside for a bit, with Occupy, we found ourselves coming across information like this really, really easily. And what was interesting was, you know, a lot of the people who are going to be listening to this are quite aware of what everyone's been talking about already. But a lot of people in Occupy were just people who were just moved by their gut to go there. They felt it was something that I'm going to put my time into. So there's a lot of people who didn't know about all this. And that was what was really interesting, the connections between just this corruption. I feel safe about saying that word, to be honest, Phil. And there was one corporation that we focused on, Xstrata. 21 of the Occupy activists were arrested occupying the Xstrata CEO's building because he was the highest paid CEO in 2011. And it was an interesting experience because we wanted to back them up in their court cases by finding out information about this. We didn't even know what Xstrata did. And that was a real learning curve for everybody because instantly we were able to find out stuff about human rights abuses and environment abuses globally by Xstrata. And so we broadened the search so we could kind of bolster our argument and realise that this is how everything runs in terms of corrupting government. You know, the revolving door, that phrase that Eva uses, is a really important phrase. It's because, you know, New Internationalists went on a lot about this when they were talking about what kind of economy would we like to see in the future. You've got to close those revolving doors because that's what's allowed all of this to be happening. And, you know, Xstrata led on to BP, led on to Glencore. Xstrata and Glencore are famously merging. And your story about Thatcher is amazing, actually. It's really good to hear something new about her. But same thing is happening with Blair in the sense that he was paid £1 million to ease the Qatari wing who were kind of saying they wanted more money for this merger between Xstrata and Glencore. It's all to do with the share prices and the worth of the Xstrata share prices. And it's the same kind of thing. He was just flown in. And I bet he had a British flag in front of me when he did the meeting as well, you know. And he eased it all for £1 million. So it's gross corruption that's been going on for a really, really long time. And, you know, with the fantastic report that Alex has done, which I really recommend all your listeners, look at the infographic. What's the website called again? It's
wdm.org.uk/carboncapital.
Right, OK. And it's the infographic there, it's brilliant to use, but for people who've been looking at this area for a long time, it's not new. I'm not saying that the research isn't new, but what it reveals isn't new. You know, the phrase that you're starting off with, which is, you know, corporate oligarchy, everyone is really aware of that. But what's really frustrating is that although there is a fair amount of the population who are aware of this kind of situation, it's a very small part of the population. And what I'm interested in is, how does that translate to the general public knowing about this? You know, this was hidden away in The Guardian, the least read paper in the country. And instead, we have rubbish on our front pages. I mean, you know, if you're looking at corporate control of the, say, fossil fuel corporations, corporate control of the media is possibly as damaging in a way. You know, although our futures are highly suspect as a species if we continue with this addiction to fossil fuels, what's even more damaging, I think, is our inability for the mass population to know about this in a clear-cut way, because if they did and realised their threat to their future, people would be out in the streets in horror. But instead, it's a tiny article hidden away in The Guardian, so that control of the media. And that's exactly the same. You know, that revolving door between government and media control is just, you know, perfect match. You can map these maps. You can do it with media. You can do it with the fossil fuel corporations. You definitely do it with the financial institutions. It's all the same, you know.
I mean, I think some of the, you know, Occupy seem to offer a space for popular anger about these issues. I mean, particularly after the financial crisis and, you know, things like privatisation of the NHS and kind of cuts all across the board to public services. I mean, there was a genuine need for that space.
Yeah. I mean, what was remarkable about them was instead of it... This is why I got very excited about it and actually spent 6 months there, because it's the first time I've been involved in a sort of campaign group that wasn't focusing on one specific area. It was economic justice that we were fighting for, really. And the initial statement was talking about, you know, this system is broken, it's unsustainable, it's corrupt. So it's systemic change, you know, and all of these campaigns tie into economic injustice, you know.
Yeah. These things that are hitting people in their daily lives, you know, the people are getting squeezed. We're all getting squeezed now through cuts to services and welfare and jobs, etc. But the kind of overarching existential threat that we've referred to of climate change is more difficult for people to get a grasp on, but maybe, you know, more serious and more urgent. Was that difficult to get a recognition of that in inside Occupy London, for example?
Yeah, it's an interesting point that with our initial statement, I think there were 10 points initially, and there wasn't a specific point about climate change. So that was an amendment that got added later, you know, which is, it was implied, but you needed a specific one. But you're going to come across this across the whole of the general public, that the way that, you know, to go back to this control of media, the reason people aren't filling the streets in horror at this climate chaotic future is the industry is using exactly the same technique as the smoking industry did in the 50s in America, when it was proved, scientists came out and said smoking causes lung cancer. So all the tobacco companies got together, and this was the early days of public relations, you know, and they said, help us. And they came out with, you know, an apparently scientific sounding title. They invented this group. They had so-called experts who were putting their names to it. And they were saying, they were wording their kind of arguments against the doctors who were proving it's causing lung cancer. They were wording it in a way that wasn't illegal, but it was causing doubt in the mass population. And that's exactly what's happening today, in the sense that, you know, all the time on radio shows, they still do this thing of, well, we'll have to have someone for climate change and someone who says it's not happening. You know, so instantly for the listeners, they're going, oh, right, so it's not you know, incontrovertibly true. We're still out about that. There's pros. Rubbish. It's absolute rubbish. But by sowing the seeds of doubt, you know, the rest of the Americans kept smoking fags and killing themselves. It's very comparable if you look at it like that, because in a way, smoking fags and the oil industry are really comparable. We're clogging up the whole lungs of the Mother Earth, you know. And a lot of people are now arguing, do you know what? We don't deserve to be here. You know, the species, there's a lot of, you know, groups like Dark Mountain, for example, and with their belief of collapsonomics, who are fantastic to listen to. But they're all like, no, we're wiped out. We're gone. It's fine. The planet will revive and save itself. But, you know, we're definitely gone. You know, you have conversations with them and they're talking about, you know, how will we arm ourselves? We'll use militias, you know, when the last food's here. It's pretty dark times. I mean, I'm very positive in the sense that, you know, this species is incredible, but at the moment, and I hope it's the dying time of this chapter of shame, we're in the grips of, well, you know, a corporate oligarchy or a corporatocracy, and it's been controlling the world for a very long time. I mean, that quote that you said, we need to take a lead from BP, that's terrifying, but that's exactly what's going on. You know, I don't think governments have had any say, really, in what's happening in the planet since the 50s. It's all been corporations ever since then. You know, Alex touched on the, you know, the weapons industry, you know, the militarised weapons industry. You know, that global complex is way more powerful than Obama. You know, and, you know, Cameron, which doesn't mean anything. BP, that means something. Shell, that means something. They hold the power. Of course, they're doing the fracking industry, exactly.
Okay. Well, that's a good place to take a breather, probably. We're going to have a short musical interlude, and then we're going to come back and see if we can say some constructive things about how we might address this kind of underlying problem. Thank you. So welcome back. That was Geta Two Mercuria and the X and Friends. Do check out their latest CD, Jan Besor Tezeta on Turp Records. Very good indeed. And I wanted to kick off the second half of this programme, which is more of an open-ended discussion about democracy and climate change, and ask the question that I sent to people originally when I invited them into this discussion, which was last year I read the book Bury the Chains, which was about a struggle to end the slave trade in the UK, and I found it very interesting to discover that it was only through a reform of democracy by making Parliament more representative through the 1832 Reform Act that legislation to abolish slavery was finally able to pass the following year. And that was because finally Parliament became slightly more representative, and it meant that there were less people in government that were, supporting the slave trade or had direct interests in the slave trade. So if we look at the state of our democracy today and some of the things we were talking about in the first half of the programme, it looks very much like a corporate-led institution, and maybe we should be focusing all our attention on addressing this rather than kind of single-issue campaigns. Maybe if we all kind of put our energies into a single campaign, kicking the corporate interest really out of government. I mean, it wouldn't be easy to do, and it'd be... And maybe it would only end up being a partial reform. Who knows? Maybe you could do it in an incremental way. But if we were able to reform Parliament, maybe it would make all our campaigning a lot easier because there'd be less of this influence going on. Can I just get an initial response to that from everybody just to before we kind of open the thing up? I know you're slightly disadvantaged there, either being on the phone, but do you have any thoughts about that proposal?
Yeah, I mean, you'd need to attach that reform to people's directly experienced interest. If we made the demand now, we need to reform Parliament. I don't think it would be particularly resonant. I can't really imagine it on a banner. I can't really imagine people organising around it. I suspect that it's when we do start to experience more and more climate violence on an environmental level, but also in a sort of economic apartheid level, that people start to recognise that the government is up to its necks in it, the government is not acting in our interest because continuously they're supporting corporate interests that are going to be, I think, ever more starkly associated with corruption. And I guess it's happening now with the big six energy companies. I mean, people hate these companies. You know, they're literally forcing people to choose between heating and eating. So it might be then that people recognise that, you know, we need to change this state and we need to change government. And actually through energy system reform and bringing about putting on the table the solution of directly community-controlled renewable energy, if we can get that rolled out further and further, then I think that could also lead to a lot more kind of localised democratic decision-making, because it's something that will feel much more tangible to people. And it's a massive thing, you know, how we source our energy, where we get it from. But, yeah, I sound a bit rambly, but I think it's got to be linked to people's, you know, core issues of self-sustainability, work, housing, energy, food, these kind of issues. But I guess the climate crisis threatens all of that, so it's a way in. But I think we have to keep bringing it back to kind of kitchen table experiences.
Yeah. Alex, what does WDM think about this? I mean, obviously you've kick-started some kind of campaign with this recent report. Where are you thinking of going with it? And is this does any of this democratic reform idea resonate?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's very interesting to think about things in terms of a form of democracy, but I don't think there's one sort of simple demand of government that will just make everything better. I mean, I think what we do need in general terms is as a radical reorientation of our entire political and economic system. I mean, in the current kind of situation, What we have is a system that's completely captured by corporate interests, that we have banks and pensions whose funds and money all flowing into sort of fossil fuels, you know, the arms industry and all sorts of awful stuff. And I think to be able to reclaim that, we need to sort of rediscover sort of the long lost art of regulation that we sort of lost in the 1970s. We need to sort of look beyond the sort of narrow, sort of myopic 1980s, post 1980s orthodoxy in economics. And, you know, I think this is a very big thing. You know, it's not something that will be solved by sort of a simple demand that sort of campaigning organisations can all rally around. I think this is something which we all have to work together in sort of in terms of a broader narrative. But I think there's a lot to be done there, which will require a lot of coordination. And I think there is something in thinking about democracy and politics. But it is that just one part of, you know, the entire web, the sort of dirty sort of carbon, high fossil fuel web that's kind of in control of our economy. And, you know, when we're in a situation, as, you know, was talked about earlier, where our diplomatic services are completely sort of, you know, enthralled to the oil companies, where even sort of the former head of MI6 is now working for Kosmos Energy, drilling for oil in Ghana. You know, this is a situation where sort of high carbon has sort of penetrated the very DNA of our political society, and I think nothing short of radical sort of reorientation and sort of a rediscovery of regulation will actually solve that problem. And yes, thinking about democracy and changing our political system may well be part of that.
Mm. I mean, I guess there's a tension between the current kind of market fundamentalism, if you like, that is the kind of dominant ideology that is resistant to regulation, and we all know about how light touch regulation led to the financial crisis, for example. We're facing an uphill struggle. But I mean, Emma, did you have any thoughts whether this kind of campaign might have any legs?
I mean, I think in terms of tackling the climate crisis, reforming democracy is completely crucial to that. And we've spoken about the revolving door, but that's only a symptom of the problem, really, and it's symptomatic of a democracy which has been totally co-opted by the market. And, you know, our democracy serves the needs of the market to create profit, not social wealth, and it's therefore not surprising that our energy is then used to create profit rather than social wealth. But I mean, I think both Eva and Alex are right in that it's how do you turn that into a tangible demand that resonates with people. And you need to show people things that can really physically disrupt the flow of capital and the flow of political support to energy projects. So I totally agree with Eva that community-owned renewable energy projects are a great way of showing that. And then there's other sort of demands. Something that we're working on a platform is how to make visible the connections between state and corporations, and how to make demands that try to pull state and corporations apart. And one thing that we think is really important is an end to fossil fuel subsidies, because as long as these subsidies continue, fossil fuel extraction will continue to be profitable, and oil and gas companies are not going to change of their own accord. As long as these activities are profitable, they're going to continue extracting oil and gas. And, you know, there's a number of subsidies from, you know, the obvious stuff like tax breaks in North Sea oil production to the things that are less tangible but equally important. Things like the diplomatic support I was talking about and also, you know, military escorts for the export of tankers, the Department of UK Export Finance underwriting fossil fuel extraction projects and the building of fossil fuel infrastructure. And perhaps the biggest subsidy of all is fossil fuel companies passing on the cost of climate change onto people. It's impossible to know exactly what that figure will be, but some studies have estimated that it's about 190 billion. So we really need to tackle this by both stopping direct transfers of cash, but also mapping out and calling for an end to these kind of more implicit subsidies, just as a first way to sort of show and make visible the vast web of support there are for oil corporations, and to start talking about some of these issues around democracy.
Okay. Jamie, do you think this idea has got any legs? I think there's a scope for a popular, kick the corporations out of government kind of style campaign.
I think, well, yes, definitely. There's scope for it, but again, it's how it's pitched at, it's how it arrives at the public's consciousness. Mm. And that's really what seems to me the main problem, you know. All of these ideas coming from the rest of your guests are really powerful. What Eva's talking about with, sort of local democracy, localised energy sources, I think is really important. And it reminds me of Climate Camp taught me about a great phrase by Buckminster Fuller, which is famously, if you want to remove a system, you have to create another system that makes the previous system obsolete. I'm paraphrasing, I can't remember word for word. But those kind of initiatives where something's working, people see that something's working and it's outside of this corrupt state, but it's working and supporting people, then that's a really good way forward. But also the kind of report that Alex has been working on and his idea of returning to regulation and, in fact, a rediscovery of regulation, of course, that would be a really fantastic route to take as well. Everyone's idea is really important, but I keep thinking the whole time is you've got to make people care. And this is such a selfish country that really it's only when it's going to be on people's doorsteps, which is beginning to happen now, that people begin to care. And that's what's outrageous. I don't know how this happened to this species, but we seem to become disconnected. I keep thinking of Thatcher. Maybe it's the nightmare I'm having at the moment. I don't know. But how did we become completely detached from what's happening to the rest of the world, the rest of the speeches, the future of our children and grandchildren? Why don't we care about that? That's just strange. I think we've been dehumanised slowly by this advanced sort of deregulated capitalism, a kind of frothing dog that should be taken out the back and shot, because it's affected our human species at every level. And you know, we need people to genuinely care, not care because, you know, the cost of my house might go down because I'm now more, you know, it's more likely that we might have floods or you know, our food's gone up. Things are more expensive because of the failure of a crop due to climate chaos. So, you know, not just affecting your immediate little circle. And I think that's what Thatcher had a lot to do with. There was this idea of, you know, there is no society. Just go out there and do it for yourselves and make lots of money for yourself, loads of money, you know. And that mentality has actually dehumanised us. I feel that really strongly. And I think there's a more... Oh, by the way, folks, I haven't got the answers here either. I'm just saying these are the directions that I think are really important to look at. Is how do you reconnect people with their humanity? That's the base.
I've got some answers.
So okay. Yeah, great. Eva, take it away.
Just two things. We need to have some collective participatory wins in this country, and it's been a while since that's happened. I mean, there have been some kind of morale-raising, confidence-building sort of mass confrontations historically. I mean, I'm thinking actually just recently, UK Uncut. It's not a huge confrontation, but it's had a real resonance. And that's coming from, you know, horizontally organised direct action group that's succeeded in getting people out, grandmas, you know, kids, everybody out together and confronting corporations, forcing them to be on the back foot, be on the defensive, forcing the whole issue of redistribution of wealth and resources into the public sphere. That's really important. But there's two other things that are really important. One is we need to stop the dash for gas. Of course, I'm going to say that. But if we can knock that out, I mean, the climate movement succeeded in killing new coal, succeeded in stalling the third runway at Heathrow, and now we can, if we get together, start targeting gas, because if that is knocked out, then we will have to go down a more renewable-orientated route. If we make it politically impossible, we'll make it economically impossible as well, and that hopefully regulation will come in the wake of that. So there is an action planned this summer, but I can't say much about it until we announce it. But something more is coming, and we want it to be very inclusive, and it will be open, and it will be participatory, not a secret squirrel thing involving 21 people up a chimney. We want to bring along those 64,000 people plus who got on board and signed the petition to force EDF to drop the big lawsuit against us. And that was a win. And I think, you know, all those 64,000 people and more felt part of that win. But there's another thing that we really need to do, and that is to support unions and support working class organisation in this country, which has had an absolute hammering from the 70s onwards. And the biggest infrastructure project in Europe, Crossrail, is on our doorstep. It's in our country. It's a 90% agency casualised site. The other 10% is going to be four men in management. So everybody there is a precarious worker, and thousands of workers. And also there are no unions there. And Unite is embarking on a big campaign right now, along with workers that were sacked for raising health and safety concerns, and the Blacklist Support Group. And just if people don't know what blacklisting is, it means... And there are activists like Helen and Dave from at Libel, my friend who's a climate activist up north, he was on that blacklist. There was a consulting agency called the Consulting Association that compiled a blacklist of activists and workers, and those workers never worked again in construction because, you know, managers revealed, you know, don't employ these people, they're troublemakers. So there's a real need to end blacklisting as a practice because, I mean, it can happen to you as a worker in any workplace. It doesn't have to be heavy industry. So we, you know, there's a big campaign starting up next week to get union recognition within Crossrail and to get those sacked workers back to work and stop the practice of blacklisting. And I see that as a class war battlefield, actually, and a real front of resistance against casualisation, which is the race to the bottom of, you know, zero-hour contracts, no rights, nothing. So I think we need to fight back on that level as well. I think we are in a class war. It's here, it's happening, and we need to participate in winning, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's an open discussion at this point, so anybody can. I don't want to mediate particularly. If anyone wants to respond to.
I know I've gabbled on forever. One very quick point, which was related to Crossrail that I forgot to mention. And, you know, we're going to talk to this organisation. Friends of the Earth really supports Crossrail. Lots of environmental groups do because it's rail and it's not air travel. However, this is an opportunity for, you know, climate NGOs to come out and say, environmental rights, climate justice is indivisible from workers' rights and social justice.
Just to add, I think like Eva's exactly right to identify that all of these things are, you know, interlinked in a systematic way because they're all a part of the capitalist system. So, you know, energy companies making profit, not only does it, you know, increase prices for people here, push people into fuel poverty, but it also then increases repression and hinders democracy in places like Azerbaijan. And that's, you know, that's what the Dash for Gas is doing. And that is being pushed by companies, but then entrenched in like European energy policy and making those links between different places, I think is really important. And I do slightly disagree with Jamie because I'm not sure that it's that people don't care. I think it's more that people are told there's no way for them to care, in that there's no way for them to take meaningful action about these things. There's no way that they can have agency, and there's no way that they can change these things. So I do think highlighting alternatives is an important part of the solution as well. To return to renewable energy cooperatives, particularly, you know, like community owned ones, where really people's need is put first rather than money, and we can challenge like energy company monopolization and show that energy can be both affordable and not massively damage our climate. That isn't impossible. These things can happen. And I mean, there's loads of inspiring examples from MST in Brazil to Denmark to Germany to renewable energy co-ops springing up here. I think showcasing those alternatives and showcasing how they challenge corporate power and how they disrupt capital is another important part of it.
Do you have any responses from that? I mean, Alex, perhaps NGOs are getting it in the neck a bit, in the sense that, you know, how do people get involved in these campaigns? You know, how do they express their anger or have agency, as Emma put it? You know, I know you've done an amazing report, but. There's, you know, it's a kind of I can click through and I can email Vince Cable and ask him very, very politely to try and change the rules of the game a bit. I mean, can you defend that type of position? Or do you think that your report can enable some kind of springboard to other kind of activism?
I mean, it was a very difficult question, but I mean. I think the movement can be quite broad. I don't think, you know, it's either or, you know, we either have NGOs or we have sort of grassroots social movements. I mean, we hope we hope we at the World Development Movement see ourselves as part of that movement. Mm. We may write reports, and we may even ask you to email Vince Cable, which we actually are currently, funnily enough. If people listening want to participate in our new carbon capital campaign, we're actually asking supporters to email Vince Cable and to demand that banks and other financial institutions are forced to report on how much money they're ploughing into fossil fuels. But that's, as I said, campaigning and the sort of activities that NGOs like WDM do is one part of that broader movement. So I don't think it's useful to sort of see it as a kind of, yeah, tension at all. Okay. I think definitely everything that's, I agree with a lot has been said so far today. I think we need to see this as being part of a broader movement. It's not just the climate justice movement and then the UK Uncut movement, Occupy separately. I think we need to conceive of ourselves increasingly as part of one movement. And we may have different niches and specializations within that movement. World Development Movement, we have decided to concentrate on the City of London and to move and sort of redefine climate as being an issue for the whole economy and not just something for environmental campaigners. And we've redefined it historically as a development issue, as an international development issue for poorer countries. And where we've so I think in short that's what we need to be doing. We need to be moving towards conceiving ourselves as being part of this, part of that broad movement.
Yeah, go on.
Can I just add to what Alex was saying about targeting governments? Because even though, WDM's report shows how governments are captured by corporates, but, they also, to some extent, still rely on voters a bit. So, people can still have influence there. And because they're so captured by corporates, it certainly shouldn't be the only tactic we use. But sometimes, if you make something politically untenable, you can affect change. And we really do need to try and drive a wedge between state and corporates to make it unacceptable that there is this revolving door, that there are just these completely complicit interests. It's not easy to do, but it is still important to have that critique and try and take that kind of action.
Okay, we've only got time for like a 10-second final thought, and I'm going to throw one in, which is we haven't talked about the liability that fossil fuel investments represents increasingly, if we are to do anything to try and maintain a livable planet. We need to keep, the overwhelming majority of fossil the reserves that are held in fossil fuel companies' reserves cannot be burned. So this is actually a liability. So I think I'd throw that in. 10 seconds, I have more than 10 seconds for my final thought, but I think Jamie probably deserves one, and Eva as well on the phone there.
I'll go first because I want to back up supporting UK Uncut. They've got a big action on Saturday that's coming. The show's going to come out on Monday. But also, I do agree that if we can actually, if the public sees significant wins, then they're more encouraged to go, this does work, and we do have to come out. And that would be brilliant, brilliant, brilliant to see. So I back that up with following up on Crossrail and also the big action in the summer for Stop the Dash for Gas.
So they're going to evict a millionaire, is that one?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's going to be busy. Yeah.
And Eva?
My last word. Yeah, what we need is confidence and as much collective cooperation and kind of finding each other, spending time together. Occupy really managed to bring so many disparate people together to talk about what they want and what they need to change. And it's creating those opportunities that are really important. And definitely the August action will do that. And, having a win against casualisation and against the exploitation of workers and union busting and censorship of activists, which is what blacklisting is, I think that will be really, really, really useful and empowering for many people.
All right. Well, thanks very much, everybody, for coming in again. And go to climateradio.org, where we'll try and reference as much as possible that we've talked about in this programme.